8. The presentation of the revelation or of the imparted truth and its precipitation into the world of illusion comes next. In that world of illusion, it undergoes the fiery ordeal wherein some of the fire within that which is revealed wings its way back to the source from whence it came. Some of it serves to destroy the revealer, and some to burn those who recognize the revelation. This is a phase of Agni Yoga, which, as you can see, is only for those who can penetrate beyond the angel into the place where fire dwelleth, and where God, the Presence, functions as a consuming fire and waits for the hour of total revelation. This is a symbolic rendering of a great truth. In the case of the individual initiate, the third initiation, the transfiguration, marks the consummation of the process. Only glory then is seen. Only the voice of the Presence is heard, and union with the past, the present, and the future is reached. 9. The succumbing of the revelation to the prevailing illusion is descent into the world of glamour, and its subsequent disappearance as a revelation, and its emergence as a doctrine. But in the meantime, humanity has been helped and led forward. The intuitives continue to work, and the inflow of that which is to be revealed never ceases. This basic technique underlies both primary and secondary revelations. In the case of the first, the time cycle is long. In the second, the time cycle is short. A very good instance of this process is demonstrated by one of the secondary points of revelation in connection with the teaching which emanated from the hierarchy, the custodian of secondary revelations as Shambhala is of primary, 50 years ago, and which took the form of the secret doctrine. HPB was the penetrating, sensing, appropriating intuitive. The revelation she conveyed followed the accustomed routine of all secondary revelation from the source to the outer plane. There the minds of men, veiled by illusion and clouded by glamour, formulated it into an inelastic doctrine, recognizing no further revelation and holding steadily, many of the theosophical groups, that the secret doctrine was a final revelation, and that naught must be recognized but that book, and naught deemed correct but their interpretations of that book. If they are correct, then evolutionary revelation is ended, and the plight of humanity is hard indeed. Even the neophyte upon the way of the intuition can begin to develop in himself the power to recognize that which the lower mind cannot give him. Some thought of revealing potency, to be used for the helping of the many, may drop into his mind. Some new light upon an old, old truth may penetrate, releasing the truth from the trammels of orthodoxy, thus illumining his consciousness. This he must use for all, and not for himself alone. Little by little he learns the way into the world of the intuition. Day by day and year by year, he becomes more sensitive to divine ideas, and more apt in appropriating them wisely for the use of his fellow men. The hope of the world and the dispelling of illusion lies in the development of intuitives and their conscious training. There are many natural intuitives whose work is a blend of the higher psychism with flashes of true intuition. There must be the training of the exact intuitive. Paralleling their intuitive response and their effort to precipitate their intuition into the world of human thought, there must also be the steady development of the human mind so that it can grasp and apprehend what is projected, and in this too lies the hope of the race. B. Group intuition dispels world illusion. Today the world is full of illusions, many of them veiled under the form of idealisms. It is full of wishful thinking and planning, and even though much of this is rightly oriented and expresses the fixed determination of the intelligentsia to create better living conditions for the entire population of the world, the question arises, is there in the sum total of this wishful thinking enough of the essential dynamic livingness which will carry it down into physical demonstration and factual expression, and thus truly meet human need? I would point out that the two greatest revealing agents who have ever come to Earth within the range of modern history made the following simple revelations to humanity. 1. The cause of all human suffering is desire and personal selfishness. Give up desire and you will be free. 2. There is a way of liberation, and it leads to illumination. 3. It profits a man nothing to gain the whole world and lose his soul. 4. Every human being is a son of God. 5. There is a way of liberation, and it is the way of love and sacrifice. The lives of these revealers were symbolic representations of that which they taught, and the rest of their teaching but an extension of their central themes. Their contribution was an integral part of the general revelation of the ages, which has led men from the primitive state of human existence to the complex state of modern civilization. This general revelation can be called the revelation of the path, which leads out of form to the center of all life. The purity of this revelation has been preserved down the ages by a small handful of disciples, initiates, and true esotericists who have always been present upon the earth, defending the simplicity of that teaching, seeking for those who could respond to and recognize the germ or seed of truth, and training men to take their place and to tread the way of intuitive perception. One of the major tasks of the hierarchy is to seek for and find those who are sensitive to revelation and whose minds are trained so that they can formulate the emerging truths in such a way that they reach the ears of the world thinkers, relatively unchanged. All revelation, however, when put into words and word forms, loses something of its divine clarity. Much of the revelation of the past has come along the lines of the religious impulse, and as the illusion has deepened and grown in time, the original simplicity, as it was conveyed by its revealers, has been lost. All basic revelations are presented in the simplest forms. Accretion after accretion crept in. The minds of men made the teaching complex through their mental dissertations until the great theological systems were built up, which we call, for instance, the Christian Church and the Buddhist system. Their founders would have much difficulty in recognizing the two or three fundamental and divine facts or truths which they sought to reveal and emphasize. So great is the mantle of illusion which has been thrown over the simple pronouncements of the Christ and of the Buddha. The vast cathedrals and the pompous ceremonies of the Orthodox are far removed from the humble way of the life of the Christ, the master of all the masters, and the teacher alike of angels and of men, and from the simplicity of his present way of life as he watches and waits for the return of his people to the simple way of spiritual realization. So great has been the illusion that in the West today men talk of the temporal power of the Catholic Church. The Protestant churches are split up into warring factions. The Christian Science Church is known for its ability to amass money and to teach its adherents to do so and to achieve temporary good health. The Greek Orthodox Church was corrupt throughout, and only the simple faith of the uncultured and the poor has preserved any semblance of the truth in its original simple form. They have no ability for high-sounding theological discussions, but they do believe that God is love, just simply that, that there is a way which leads to peace and light, and that if they deny their own material desires, they are pleasing God. I am, I know, widely generalizing, brother of mine, for I do know also that there are wise and good Christians and churchmen within the theological systems. These, however, spend not their time in theological discussions, but in loving their fellow men, and this they do because they love Christ and all for which he stands. They are not interested in building great churches of stone and marble, and in gathering together the money needed for their support. They are interested to gather out those who form the true church upon the inner spiritual plane and in helping them to walk in the light. The illusion of power, the illusion of superiority, taints them not. After the world crisis is over, churchmen everywhere will not rest until they can discover how to penetrate through the illusion of doctrine and dogma, which engulfs them, and find their way back to Christ and his simple message, which has in it the power to save the world, if recognized and practiced. Much of the true revelation since the time of Christ has come to the world along the line of science. The presentation, for instance, of material substance, scientifically proven, as essentially only a form of energy, was as great a revelation as any given by the Christ or the Buddha. It completely revolutionized men's thinking and was, little as you may think it, a major blow struck at the great illusion. It related energy to force, form to life, and man to God, and held the secret of transformation, transmutation, and transfiguration. The revelations of science, when basic and fundamental, are as divine as those of religion, but both have been prostituted to meet human demand. The era is close at hand when science will bend every effort to heal humanity's sores and build a better and happier world. The revelations of science, though focused often through one man or woman, are more specifically the result of group endeavor and of trained group activity than are the revelations of religion, so-called. Revelation, therefore, comes in two ways. One, through the effort, aspiration, and achievement of one man who is so close to the hierarchy and so imbued with conscious divinity that he can receive the message direct from the central divine source. He has joined the ranks of the great intuitives and works freely in the world of divine ideas. He knows his mission clearly, he chooses his sphere of activity with deliberation, and isolates the truth or truths which he deems appropriate to the need of the time. He comes forth as a messenger of the Most High, leads a dramatic and arresting life of service, and symbolizes in his life events certain basic truths which have already been revealed, but which he pictorially reenacts. He epitomizes in himself the revelations of the past, and to them adds his own contribution of the new revelation, which it is his specific function to present to the world. 2. Through the effort of a group of seekers, such as the scientific investigators in every country, who together are searching for light on the problems of manifestation, or for some means to alleviate human suffering, a revelation comes. The effort of such a group often lifts upon the wings of its unrealized aspiration some one man who can then penetrate into the world of divine ideas and there find the longed-for cure or key, and thus he intuitively discovers a long-sought secret. The discovery, when of the first rank, is as much a revelation as the truths presented by the world teaches. Who shall say that the statement that God is love is of more value than the statement that all is energy? The route which the revelation then follows is the same in both cases, and illusion overtakes both forms of revelation. But, and here is a point upon which I would ask you to reflect, there is a little less illusion gathered around the revelations of science than has gathered around the revelations of what humanity calls the more definitely spiritual truths. One reason lies in the fact that the last great spiritual revelation given by the Christ was given 2,000 years ago, and the development of man's mind and his responsiveness to truth has grown greatly since that time. Again, the revelations of science are largely the result of group tension, eventually focused in one intuitive recipient, and the revelation is thereby protected. Today, as humanity awaits the revelation which will embody the thoughts and dreams and constructive goal of the new age, the demand comes for the first time from a large group of intuitively inclined people. I said not intuitives, brother of old. This group is now so large, and its focus is now so real, and its demand so loud, that it is succeeding in focusing the massed intent of the people. Therefore, whatever revelation may emerge in the immediate future will be better protected by the spirit of understanding than any previous one. This is the significance of the words of the New Testament, "Every eye shall see him." Humanity as a whole will recognize the revealing one. In past ages, the messenger from on high was only recognized by and known to a mere handful of men, and it took decades and sometimes centuries for his message to penetrate into the hearts of humanity. The stress of the times also, and the development of the sense of proportion, plus an enforced return to simplicity of living and requirements, may save the coming revelation from too swift and quick submergence in the fire of the great illusion. It will be apparent to you from the above that the mode of handling world affairs, states of consciousness, and conditions in the three worlds is one in which the disciple and initiate work from above downwards. The method is, in reality, a repetition of the involutionary arc in which, like the Creator from a vantage point of exterior direction, energy, force, and forces are directed into the world of phenomena and produce definite effects upon the substance of the three planes. This is a point which should be most carefully remembered, and it is for this reason that the technique of the presence must always be employed prior to all other techniques. It establishes contact with the directing spiritual agent and enables the disciple to assume the attitude of the detached observer and an agent of the plan. When this technique is correctly followed, it brings the intuition into play, and the world of meaning lying behind the world of phenomena stands revealed, thereby dispelling illusion. Truth, as it is seen and known. Forms in the outer world of phenomena, outer from the angle of the soul, and therefore encompassing the three worlds of our familiar daily living, are seen to be but symbols of an inward and spiritual reality. 2. The technique of light. We come now to the consideration of the next development and service to be rendered through the medium of another technique. This theme is so vast, and there is so much literature to be found in all the world's scriptures, commentaries, and theological dissertations on the subject of light, that the simple truth and a few basic principles are lost to sight in a welter of words. In my various books, I have given much anent this subject, and in the book The Light of the Soul, which I wrote in collaboration with AAB, an effort was made to indicate the nature of the light of the soul. The key to this technique is to be found in the words, "In that light shall we see light." A simple paraphrase of these apparently abstract and symbolic words could be given as follows. When the disciple has found that lighted center within himself and can walk in its radiating light, he is then in a position, or in a state of consciousness, if you prefer, wherein he becomes aware of the light within all forms and atoms. The inner world of reality stands visible to him as light substance, a different thing to the reality revealed by the intuition. He can then become an efficient cooperator with the plan because the world of psychic meaning becomes real to him, and he knows what should be done to dispel glamour. It might be stated that this process of bringing light into dark places falls naturally into three stages. 1. The stage wherein the beginner and the aspirant endeavor to eradicate glamour out of their own life by the use of the light of the mind. The light of knowledge is a major dispelling agent in the earlier phases of the task and effectively eliminates the various glamours which veil the truth from the aspirant. 2. The stage wherein the aspirant and disciple work with the light of the soul. This is the light of wisdom, which is the interpreted result of long experience, and this streams forth, blending with the light of knowledge. 3. The stage wherein the disciple and the initiate work with the light of the intuition. It is through the blended medium of the light of knowledge, personality light, and the light of wisdom, soul light, that the light is seen, known, and appropriated. This light puts out the lesser lights through the pure radiance of its power. You have, therefore, the light of knowledge, the light of wisdom, and the light of the intuition, and these are three definite stages or aspects of the one light. They correspond to the physical sun, the heart of the sun, and the central spiritual sun. In this last sentence, you have the clue and the key to the relation of man to the Logos. These stages and their corresponding techniques are apt to be misunderstood if the student fails to remember that between them lie no real lines of demarcation, but only a constant overlapping, a cyclic development, and a process of fusion which is most confusing to beginners. Just as the result of innate reaction to environment produces the apparatus needed to contact that environment, so the unfoldment of the powers which these techniques serve produces modes of contact with soul and spiritual environments. Each of these techniques is related to a new environment. Each of them eventually develops power in the initiate or disciple, which can be used in the service of humanity and in higher spheres of divine activity. Each is related to the other techniques, and each releases the disciple into a conscious relationship with a new environment, new states of awareness, and new fields of service. For instance, 1. The technique of the presence, when successfully followed, enables the intuition to flow in and to supersede the activity of the rationalizing mind and to dispel illusion, substituting for that illusion divine ideas, formulated into concepts which we call ideals. The masters, it should be remembered, only use the mind for two activities, A. to reach the minds of their disciples and attract aspirants through the medium of an instrument similar to the disciples' mind. B. to create thought forms on concrete levels which can embody these divine ideas. The directing agent, the angel of the presence, produces the power to create in this manner, and this we call the result of the intuition, idea or truth, its perception, and its reproduction. 2. The technique of light is more closely related to the mind and signifies the method whereby the illumination which flows from the soul, whose nature is light, can irradiate not only ideals, but life, circumstances, and events, revealing the cause and the meaning of the experience. When the power of the disciple to illumine is grasped, he has taken the first step towards dispelling glamour, and just as the technique of the presence becomes effective upon the mental plane, so this technique produces powers which can become effective on the astral plane and eventually bring about the dissipation and the disappearance of that plane. 3. The technique of indifference renders ineffective or neutralizes the hold of substance over the life or spirit functioning in the three worlds, for soul is the evidence of life. In connection, therefore, with this second technique, I would like to take some words out of the Bible, substituting the word light for the word faith. I give you this definition. Light is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This is perhaps one of the most occult definitions of the light of the world that has yet been given, and its true meaning is intended to be revealed in the next two generations. The word faith is a good instance of the method of rendering blind some of the ancient truths so that their significance may not be prematurely revealed. Light and substance are synonymous terms. Soul and light are equally so, and in this equality of idea, light, substance, soul, you have the key to fusion and to the at-one-ment which Christ expressed so fully for us in his life on earth. When, therefore, students and aspirants have made progress in soul contact, they have taken one of the first important steps towards the comprehension of light and its uses. They must, however, be careful not to confuse the light which they can bring to bear on life, circumstance, events, and on environment with the intuition. The light with which we are concerned expresses itself in the three worlds and reveals form and forms, their reaction and effect, their glamour and attractive appeal, and their power to delude and imprison consciousness. The light concerned is soul light, illuminating the mind and bringing about revelation of the world of forms in which that life is immersed. The intuition is concerned with nothing whatsoever in the three worlds of human experience, but only with the perceptions of the spiritual triad and with the world of ideas. The intuition is to the world of meaning what the mind is to the three worlds of experience. It produces understanding, just as the light of soul produces knowledge through the medium of that experience. Knowledge is not a purely mental reaction, but is something which is found on all levels and is instinctual in some form in all kingdoms. This is axiomatic. The five senses bring physical plane knowledge. Psychic sensitivity brings a knowledge of the astral plane. The mind brings intellectual perception, but all three are aspects of the light of knowledge coming from the soul as it informs its vehicles of expression in the vast threefold environment in which it chooses to imprison itself for purposes of development. On a higher turn of the spiral, the intuition is the expression of the threefold spiritual triad, placing it in relation to the higher levels of divine expression. It is a result of the life of the monad, an energy which carries revelation of divine purpose. It is in the world of this divine revelation that the disciple learns eventually to work, and in which the initiate consciously functions. Of this higher experience, the active life of the three worlds is a distorted expression, but constitutes also the training ground in which capacity to live the initiate life of intuitional perception and to serve the plan is slowly developed. These distinctions in time and space, because all distinctions are part of the great illusion, though necessary and inevitable when the mind controls, must be carefully considered. Disciples will reach a point in their development where they will know whether they are reacting to the light of the soul or to the intuitional perception of the triad. They will then come to the point where they will realize that intuitive perception, as they call it, is only the reaction of the illumined personality to the identification tendency of the triad. But these concepts are beyond the grasp of the average man, because fusion and identification are by no means the same. The rules for the technique of light have been adequately laid down in the Raja Yoga system of Patanjali, of which the five stages of concentration, meditation, contemplation, illumination, and inspiration are illustrative. These, in their turn, must be paralleled by a following of the five rules and the five commandments. I would ask you to study these. They, in their turn, produce the many results in psychic sensitivity, of which hierarchical contact, illumination, service, and discipline are descriptive, and finally, the stage of isolated unity, which is the paradoxical term used by Patanjali to describe the inner life of the initiate. Most of what I have said above is well known to all aspirants, whether they study the Raja Yoga teaching of India or the life of practical mysticism as laid down by such mystics as Meister Eckhart and the more mentally polarized modern esotericists. These latter went beyond the mystical vision by arriving at fusion. I need not enlarge on this. It is the higher stage of at-one-ment to which all true mystics bear witness. What does concern us here is how this light is recognized, appropriated, and used in order to dispel glamour and render a deeply esoteric service to the world. It might be said that the inner light is like a searchlight, swinging out into the world of glamour and of human struggle from what one master has called the pedestal of the soul and the spiritual tower or beacon. These terms convey the idea of altitude and of distance, which are so characteristic of the mystical approach. Power to use this light as a dissipating agent only comes when these symbols are dropped and the server begins to regard himself as the light and as the irradiating center. Herein lies the reason for some of the technicalities of the occult science. The esotericist knows that in every atom of his body is to be found a point of light. He knows that the nature of the soul is light. For eons, he walks by means of the light engendered within his vehicles, by the light within the atomic substance of his body, and is therefore guided by the light of matter. Later, he discovers the light of the soul. Later still, he learns to fuse and blend soul light and material light. Then he shines forth as a light bearer, the purified light of matter and the light of the soul being blended and focused. The use of this focused light as it dispels individual glamour teaches the disciples the early stages of the technique which will dispel group glamour and eventually world glamour, and this is the next point with which we will deal. The theme with which we are dealing, the light of the soul as it dissipates glamour in the three worlds, is the most practical and useful and needed subject for study to be found today. It concerns the astral plane, and the service to be rendered is vital and timely. The ridding of the world of the individual and the world of humanity as a whole of the all-enveloping glamour which holds humanity in thrall is an essential requirement for the race. The new era, which will open up before mankind at the close of the war, will be distinguished by its mental polarization and consequent freedom from glamour. Then illusion will, for a time, control until the intuition is more fully developed. This illusion will produce vastly different results to those which follow when men live and work in the midst of glamour. The second characteristic of the new era will be the scientific approach to the entire problem of glamour, which will then be recognized for what it is and will be scientifically dissipated by the use of the illumined minds of groups working in unison for just that purpose. The proposition, therefore, which I am laying before you, who are the aspirants and the disciples of the world, is the possibility of a definite world service. Groups will eventually be formed of those who are working at the dissipation of glamour in their individual lives, and who are doing so not so much in order to achieve their own liberation, but with the special objective of ridding the astral plane of its significant glamours. They will work unitedly on some major phase of world glamour by the power of their individual illumined minds. Unitedly, they will turn the searchlight of the mind, reflecting the light of the sun, but at the same time radiating its own inner light upon the mists and fogs of earth, for in these mists and fogs all men stumble. Within the lighted sphere of the focused radiant light, reality will issue forth triumphant. It is interesting to note that the most ancient prayer in the world refers to the three aspects of glamour, and it is for these that the three techniques must be used to make release and progress possible. As you know, this prayer runs as follows, taken from the first Upanishad of Brihadaranyaka, section 3, verse 28. Quote, "Lead us, O Lord, from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real, from death to immortality." Close quote. Lead us from darkness to light refers to the mind as it becomes eventually illumined by the light of the intuition. This illumination is brought about by the means of the technique of the presence from whom the light shines. This is the mediating factor producing the transfiguration of the personality and a center of radiant light upon the mental plane. This statement is true whether one is speaking of an individual or of that focal point of light which is formed by the mental unity and the clear thinking of advanced humanity. These, through the power of their unified minds, will succeed in ridding the world of some aspects of the great illusion. Lead us from the unreal to the real has specific relation to the astral plane and its all-encompassing glamours. These glamours embody the unreal and present them to the prisoners of the astral plane, leading them to mistake them for the reality. This imprisonment by glamour can be ended by the activity of the technique of light, utilized by those who work in group formation for the dissipation of glamour and for the emergence in the consciousness of men of a clear conception and recognition of the nature of reality. This particular work of dissipation is our immediate theme. It is of vital importance that those who recognize the open door to the future through which all men must pass should begin to carry forward this work. Only thus can humanity be helped to leave behind the errors, the glamours, and the failures of the past. It is this technique which brings freedom from glamour and which can transform human living and so bring in the new civilization and culture. This dissipation can be carried forward by disciples in all parts of the planet, aided by the world aspirants. It will, however, be primarily the work of those whose ray focus makes astral living the line of least resistance and who have learnt or are learning to dominate it by the power of thought and mental light. These are the sixth ray people in the first instance, aided by aspirants and disciples upon the second and fourth rays. In time and space, this task will be first of all instituted and controlled in group formation only by aspirants whose soul or personality rays are the sixth, or by those whose astral bodies are conditioned by the sixth ray. When they have grasped the nature of the work to be done and fanatically adopted the technique of light in the service of the race, their work will be completed by second ray disciples, working from the ashrams of those masters who take disciples. The work done by these two groups will be finally revealed, and at a much later date, by those aspirants and disciples who will swing into astral activity when the fourth ray again begins to manifest. Therefore, the work of dissipating glamour is carried forward by those who come out into manifestation along the lines of energy which embody the second, fourth, and sixth rays. I emphasize this as disciples frequently undertake tasks for which they are not particularly fitted and whose rays do not aid them in accomplishment and sometimes prevent that accomplishment. The whole subject is related to consciousness, to the second aspect, and concerns the forms through which mankind becomes progressively aware. Glamour is caused by the recognition of that which man has himself created, and, as has occultly been said, man only becomes aware of reality when he has destroyed that which he has himself created. These forms fall into two major groups. One, those forms which are of very ancient origin and which are the result of human activity, human thinking, and of human error. They embrace all the forms which the desire nature of man has created down the ages and are the nebulous substance of glamour, nebulous from the physical angle, but dense from the angle of the astral plane. They are that which provides the incentive behind all striving and activity upon the outer plane as man attempts to satisfy desire. From these forms, the individual aspirant has ever to rid himself, emerging, after so doing, through that gate which we call the second initiation, into a wider consciousness. 2. those forms which are being constantly created and ceaselessly produced in response to the aspirational nature of humanity, and which provide the enticements which lead the man along towards high personal achievement in the first instance, and spiritual achievement later. They have in them the indications of the new and the possible. These likewise, strange as it may seem, constitute a glamour, for they are temporary and illusory, and must not be permitted to hide the real. That reality will precipitate itself at the right moment once the higher light pours in. They are indicative of the real and are often mistaken for the real. They are in conflict with the old thoughts and desires of the past and must eventually give place to the factual presence of the real. They provide, in times of crisis, the great testing for all aspirants and disciples, evoking the subtlest kind of discrimination. But once that testing has been triumphantly passed, then can the task of dissipating both these types of glamour be given to the disciple and aspirant, with the emphasis upon the immediate need or any particular and current world glamour. It will be apparent to you, therefore, that groups working consciously at the service of dissipating glamour will have the following characteristics. 1. They will be composed of sixth-ray aspirants and disciples, aided by second-ray spiritual workers. 2. They will be formed of those who, A, are learning or have learnt to dissipate their own individual glamours and can bring understanding to the task. B, are focused upon the mental plane and have, therefore, some measure of mental illumination. They are mastering the technique of light. C, are aware of the nature of the glamours which they are attempting to dissipate and can use the illumined mind as a searchlight. 3. They will count among their numbers those who, occultly speaking, have the following powers in process of rapid development. A. The power not only to recognize glamour for what it is, but to discriminate between the various and many types of glamour. B. The power to appropriate the light, absorbing it into themselves, and then consciously and scientifically project it into the world of glamour. The masters, the higher initiates, and the world disciples do this alone if need be, and require not the protection of the group or the aid of the light of the group members. C. The power to use the light not only through absorption and projection, but also by a conscious use of the will, carrying energy upon the beam of projected light. To this they add a persistent and steady focus. This beam, thus projected, has a twofold use. It works expulsively and dynamically, much as a strong wind blows away or dissipates a dense fog, or as the rays of the sun dry up and absorb the mist. It acts also as a beam, along which that which is new and a part of the divine intention can enter. The new ideas and the desired ideals can come in on the beam, just as the beam directs and brings in the airplanes to a desired landing place. A. The dissipation of individual glamour. Let us first of all consider the mode by which the individual aspirant can succeed in dissipating the glamours which have for ages conditioned his life in the three worlds. He has been dominated by desire for four-fifths of his incarnated experience. He has begun to transmute his desire into aspiration, and to seek, with all the devotion, emotion, and longing of which he is capable, for realization. It is then that he becomes aware of the appalling nature of the glamours in which he automatically and normally walks. Glamour arose when man recognized and registered desire as an incentive, thus demonstrating his humanity and his distinction from the animal, because it is the mind which reveals the existence of desire. The instinctual effort to satisfy desire, innate and inherent in the lower nature, gave place to planned efforts to meet desire, involving the directive use of the mind. Thus the line of demarcation between the animal and the human has become increasingly apparent, and the first and basic expression of pure selfishness appeared eons ago. Later, as evolution proceeded and desire shifted from one planned satisfaction to another, it began to take on a less physical aspect, and men sought pleasure in emotional experience and its dramatization. This led to the establishment of the drama as its first artistic expression. By means of this, down the ages, man has supplemented individual emotional and dramatic living with a vicarious submergence in it, thus exteriorizing himself and supplementing his personal dramas, desires, and objectives with those which were developed by means of the creative imagination, thus laying the foundation for the recognition, intelligent and real, of the part in relation to the whole. Thus, from earliest Atlantean times, the foundation was laid for the unfoldment of the sense of mystical duality through the various stages of an anthropomorphic recognition of deity to the recognition of the real in man himself, until finally we arrive at the proposition which faces the disciple. Then the dweller on the threshold confronts the angel of the presence, and the last and major conflict is fought out. This dualistic consciousness culminates at the time of the third initiation in the final fight between the pairs of opposites and the triumphant victory of the angel, the embodiment of the forces of good in the individual, in the group, and in humanity. Then dualism and the desire for that which is material and not oneself, as identified with the whole, dies out. Unity and the life more abundantly is achieved. The process followed by the disciple who is consciously working at the dissipation of glamour in his life can be divided into four stages, to which the following definitions can be given. 1. The stage of recognition of the glamour or glamours which hide the real. These glamours are dependent in any particular life crisis upon the ray of the personality. 2. The stage of focusing the disciple's consciousness upon the mental plane and the gathering of the light to that point of focus, so that the illumination is clear, the work to be done is plainly seen, and the searchlight of the mind is directed upon the glamour which it is intended should be dissipated. 3. The stage of direction. This involves the steady pouring of the light under intelligent direction into the dark places of the astral plane, remembering that the light will enable the disciple to do two things. A. Dissipate the glamour, a satisfying experience. B. See the real, a terrifying experience, brother of mine. 4. The stage of identification with the real as it is contacted after the dissipation of the glamour. In the added light which is now available, there will be a further recognition of still subtler glamours which in their turn must be dissipated. This process of recognition, focusing, dissipation, and consequent revelation goes on continually from the time a disciple treads the path of accepted discipleship until the third initiation. The clue to all success in this process is, therefore, connected with meditation and the holding of the mind steady in the light. Only through steadiness can the beam of light be formed, intensified, focused, and projected, and then, at the right moment, withdrawn. I cannot here enter upon an elucidation of the process of meditation based on the right understanding of the nature of concentration. I have written much upon the subject, and the Raja Yoga discipline is well known. Mental concentration and control is now the ordinary theme of all instructions given by educators and enlightened parents. It is difficult for the average person today to realize that there was a time when such phrases as use your mind, or if you will only think, or a little mental control on your part would be useful, were totally unknown because the mind was so little developed. It was then only recognized as a functioning factor by those with initiate consciousness. The path of evolution is, in fact, the path of recognitions, leading to revelation. The whole process of evolution is initiatory in character, leading from one expansion of consciousness to another, until the worlds of the formless and of form stand revealed in the light which the initiate generates and in which he walks. These lights are varied and variously revealing. There is, 1, the light of matter itself found in every atom of substance. 2, the light of the vital or etheric vehicle, a light which is the reflection of the one light because it unifies the three types of light within the three worlds. 3, the light of the instinct. 4, the light of the intellect or the light of knowledge. 5, the light of the soul. 6, the light of the intuition. From light to light we pass, from revelation to revelation, until we pass out of the realm of light into the realm of life, which is, as yet to us, pure darkness.
End of side 1, cassette number 5, Glamour of World Problem, page 205. Continued on side 2. Side 2, cassette number 5 of Glamour, A World Problem, continuing on page 205.
It will be obvious to you that this increasing light brings with it a constantly developing series of revelations which, like all else in the world of human experience, unfolds before the eyes, first of all the world of forms, then the world of ideals, then the nature of the soul, of ideas, and of divinity. I am choosing but a few of the words which embody the revelation and are symbolic of its character. But all these revelations constitute one great unified revelation, which is slowly unfolding before the eyes of humanity. The light of the personal lower self reveals to man the world of form, of matter, of instinct, of desire, and of mind. The light of the soul reveals the nature of the relation of these forms of life to the world of the formless, and of the conflict between the real and the unreal. The light of the intuition unfolds before the vision of the soul within the personality, the nature of God, and the unity of the whole. The restlessness of material desire, seeking its satisfaction in the three worlds, eventually gives place to aspiration towards soul contact and soul life. This, in its turn, is recognized as a step towards those great fundamental experiences to which we give the names of the five major initiations. These reveal to man the hitherto unrealized fact of his non-separateness and of the relation of his individual will to the divine will. We are now going to study the mode whereby these phases of work upon the astral plane are carried forward. First, the individual learns to use the light of the mind generated by the soul as it becomes closely related to the personality and impulsed by the intuition. By means of this light, the disciple learns to dissipate his personal and private glamours. I mention this because I would have you appreciate the extent of the task a man undertakes when he consciously sets about ridding himself of glamour preparatory to extended service. He is in conflict then with the whole glamour of the entire plane and is apt to be overwhelmed by a realization of what he is facing. This is one of the causes of the deep depression and those profound inferiority complexes which render some people completely futile or lead eventually to suicide. Their own personal glamours tie them into national or planetary glamour and thus condition their life expression and their thinking. I would ask you to remember this as you deal with people and find them set in their ideas and unable to see the truth as you see it. They are as they are because their individual glamour is fed by the greater glamours, and this is as yet too much for them. It is not my intention to deal specifically with particular glamours, but to give you a formula which, with slight changes and additions, can serve the individual and the group in the task of eradicating glamour. I would begin by saying that the first need is for the man to realize that his reactions, ideas, desires, and life experience, as far as his emotional nature is concerned, are conditioned by some one glamour or glamours, that he is the victim of several glamours engendered over many lives, deeply rooted in his past history and to which he instinctually reacts. The time, however, comes when the probationary disciple becomes aware of these instinctual glamours and recognizes them on appearance, even when reacting to them. He seeks to free himself, working at first spasmodically, trying to use the mind to rationalize himself out of them and alternating between temporary success, when he can with deliberation act as if free from glamour, and long periods of defeat, when he is overwhelmed, can see no light anywhere, and acts like a blind, bewildered person. This indicates that he is drawn, as by a magnet, the force of accumulated ancient glamour with its karmic effects, into the midst of the very glamour he would seek to avoid. Later comes the stage, a result of this alternating process, when the pull of the soul begins to offset the pull of these glamours. He aspires to free expression and to liberation from astral plane control. The balancing process then takes place. It is during this stage that meditation is instituted so that the man becomes aware of soul light as it blends with the inherent light of the mental body, and this blended light steadily intensifies as he persists in the meditation work. A point then comes where the aspirant discovers that this inner light can be used, and he begins tentatively and with uneven success to turn that light upon the problems of his particular glamour. It is also at this point that we now carry forward the technique of light, employing it so that the vague, unscientific technique of the past comes to an end. The indicator technique is of use only to the man who knows something of the light of the mind, of the light in the head, and of the light of the soul. The light in the head is produced by the definitely planned bringing together of soul light and personality light, focused in the mental body and producing an effect in the brain. This focusing process falls into three stages. 1. The attempt to focus the light of the mind and of matter in the mental vehicle. This signifies a bringing together of the light of matter and substance, dense material and etheric light, and the light of the mind itself. There is no peculiar or specific light in or of the astral body itself, for it is only an aggregate of forms created by individual man, by nations, and by races, and these in their entirety constitute the astral plane and possess no inherent light as do other forms. They are not created as a form of expression for some dynamic life by the planetary logos, and this is the real meaning of what I have earlier told you, that the astral plane in reality does not exist. It is the phantasmoric creation of human desire down the ages, and its false light is a reflection of either the light of matter or of the mind. This process of focusing is undertaken through alignment and by the effort to bring to a point of illumination the positive light of the mind and the negative light of the brain, and is carried forward through mental control developed in meditation. When these two opposite poles are in relation, then, by an act of the personality will, these two aspects of the lesser light can form a pinpoint of light, like a small torchlight, revealing some phase of the glamour to which the aspirant most easily responds. This first focused light is not of such a nature that it can do more than reveal. It has no dissipating power, nor can it render existing glamour ineffective. It can only make a man aware in his waking or brain consciousness that glamour holds him. This is related to the stage of concentration in the meditation process. 2. The second stage of the focusing process is produced through the effort to meditate. In the previous stage, the blending of the two material lights was entirely a form process, and the aspirant is actuated entirely by his personality forces and expediency. An illustration of this and of its effectiveness can be seen in the man who, from purely selfish motives and through an intense concentration, focuses his mind and brings about the gratification of his desires and the achievement of his goals. He kills out all emotional reactions and goes a long way towards dissipating glamour. He develops the ability to draw on the light of matter itself, physical matter, and mental substance, and thus he generates a false light from which soul light is rigorously excluded. It is this power which eventually produces a black magician. He has developed the capacity to draw upon the light energy of matter itself and to focus it so powerfully and effectively that it becomes a great destructive force. It is this which has given Hitler and the six evil men associated with him their power to destroy upon the material plane. But in the case of the aspirant, the power to meditate upon spiritual reality and to contact the soul offsets the dangers inherent in focusing on and using solely the light of matter. To the lesser light of matter is added the light of the soul, and then these two blended lights, or aspects of the one light, are focused upon the mental plane through the power of the creative imagination. This enables man eventually to dissipate glamour and liberates him from the astral plane. 3. The third stage is that in which the light of matter, the light of the mind, and the light of the soul, as a channel for the intuition, are consciously blended, fused, and focused. The man then turns this blended light under soul direction upon the world of glamour, and upon the particular glamour with which he is at any one time preoccupied. The false light of the astral plane disappears in this triple blended light, just like a fire can be nearly put out if subjected to the full rays of the sun, or a burning glass focusing the rays of the sun can start a destructive blaze. It is the use of a powerful light which can obliterate a lesser light and dissipate a fog. All this has to be understandingly and consciously carried forward as a preliminary to the technique proper. His work will be experimental at first and scientifically applied eventually. It will be based upon a recognition of truth, a truth which is faced and accepted. This work is not a form of rationalization, though that precedes the definitely scientific work I am outlining. It is not the cultivation of fresh interests of a mental and spiritual kind which gradually supersede desire and drive out glamour. That is all preparatory in character and leads to an unfoldment which prepares the aspirant to work scientifically. It is not a process of killing out desire, as some schools of thought teach, but is a process of gradually eradicating desire by stern discipline and hard-trained work, and this, incidentally, involves the dissipation of glamour. Such have been the slow techniques of the past. Today the process is to be changed because enough people are now the product of understanding and can work wisely and also scientifically. The process I am developing for you is one of rapid and effective dissipation and is based upon the acceptance of the hypothesis of light, upon the recognition of the fact that the astral plane has no true existence, upon a trained use of the creative imagination, and upon the unquestioning following of instructions individually and as a group. It is my intention to give you two formulas, one for the use of the individual and the other which groups can use as they contribute their united effort to the dissipation of glamour, either of group glamour or in relation to some aspect of the prevalent world glamour. Two things will be apparent to you. First, that those participating in the eradication of glamour must be able to distinguish between glamour and the reality. These often closely resemble each other on a superficial examination. They must be in a position to recognize that an emotional or astral condition constitutes a veil over the truth and is a distortion of the presentation or the appearance of the individual's or the group's expression of divinity. They must therefore be capable of vision, clear thinking, and prompt recognition as to what is preventing the materializing of that vision and the accurate reception of the truth. They must also be able to distinguish between a major and a minor glamour. A minor glamour, a passing evanescent thought form of an easily recognizable nature, does not warrant the use of either of the formulas. Such a minor glamour would be a sense of self-pity in an individual, or the glorification of some notable individual by an individual, a group, or a nation. Time and common sense suffice to take care of such a situation. A major glamour in the world, prior to the war, was the emphasis put upon possessions and the belief that happiness was dependent upon things and upon material good and comfort. Second, that the three stages of focusing referred to above constitute a preparatory process. These three stages must be somewhat developed before effective use of the formulas can be possible, and those intending to work at the task of ridding the world of glamour must subject themselves constantly to these phases in the art of polarization, if I might so call it. They must have an understanding of the apparatus of thought, of the creation of thought forms, and of the nature of the thinker. They must be emotionally polarized, yet in group work, relatively free from astral control. This astral liberation must, to a certain extent, control the choice of those who are to work at major dissipations. In the case of the individual who is seeking to break up glamour in his individual life, he should be mentally polarized by decision and effort, even if the emotional nature is for him, in any one life, the line of least resistance. Those working in group formation will have achieved a measure of mental focus, but for the purposes of the work to be done, they will focus themselves consciously and deliberately upon the emotional plane through their control of their natures. Workers must therefore have practiced meditation, have reflected much upon the nature of thought and its uses, and must be aware of the light within. When these three stages are established as related activities, habits, and automatic reactions, and when the intention is fixed and the ability to focus has become an almost instinctual reaction, then sound and effective work can be done. To to this work must be added persistence and patience. It is not necessary, I might add, to have achieved perfection in the process before starting this work and service. Disciples and aspirants must cultivate the consciousness of cooperation and realization that in service such as is proposed, they are definitely participating in a hierarchical activity and are therefore in a position to render help, even if they could not, alone and unaided, achieve the desired results. They can hasten the process by their combined help. The power of united effort upon the physical plane is being realized today on a large scale, and the war effort in all countries has greatly hastened this realization. The power of unified emotion, often expressing itself in what is called mob psychology, is everywhere recognized and feared as well as exploited. The power of unified thought is little grasped as yet, and the power inherent in the light of many minds, rendering them effective instruments in world affairs, penetrating and dissipating glamour, and proving creative upon the physical plane, will prove to be a part of the new modes of work which will be employed in the new age. For this, the hierarchy has planned and worked, and it is now prepared to test the effectiveness of that work by organizing a group or groups which will work upon the problem of glamour. You can see, consequently, that what I am outlining is relatively new. The faint impression of the coming technique, as far as the individual is concerned, has been registered. Men and women everywhere are attempting to rid themselves of glamour by the power of clear thinking, stern discipline, and common sense, and by recording consciously of their relation to the whole, which prompts them to eliminate out of their lives all that could hinder others or increase world deception through glamour. To this will be added, perhaps as an aspect of the new world religion now on its way towards externalizing, the realization that groups can successfully clear away the glamours which darken humanity's way to its goal through the power of combined and projected thought. In order to make the first step towards united group activity along this line of service, I present a formula or group ritual which, if employed by those whose lives are relatively free from glamour, who are realists and who are recognized by the group as thus relatively free, and who are animated by good intent, will do much to bring to an end certain aspects of the world glamour. Their effort, combined with that of similar groups, will so weaken the power of these ancient glamours that the day of clarification will eventually come. First, however, let me briefly offer for the use of the individual aspirant a formula whereby he may aid in freeing himself from his particular glamour or glamours. I will tabulate the process, and the aspirant would do well to follow it as given, having in his mind no sense of time, and being willing to do this work regularly for months, and if necessary for years, until he has freed himself and the light breaks in on the astral plane through the medium of his astral body. I would suggest that no aspirant attempt to tackle the problem of glamour as a whole, or seek to dissipate all the glamours to which he is susceptible. He is dealing with very ancient evil, and with firmly established habits of glamour. They are closely connected with aspects of his daily living, with his sex life or with his ambitions, with his relations to other people, with his pet ideals and ideas, his dreams and visions. He should choose the glamour that is the most apparent and the most hindering at any given time, and there is always one, and for its dissipation he should work conscientiously if he would lay the foundations for effective service in the dissipation of world glamour. Formula for the dissipation of glamour for the individual. Roman numeral 1. Preparatory stages. 1. Recognition of the glamour to be dissipated. This involves a willingness to cooperate with the soul in physical, astral, and mental ways in order to aid in the more technical work. Ponder on the implications in this sentence. B. A recognition of the ways in which this glamour affects the daily life and all relationships. 2. The three stages of focusing outlined, see pages 208 to 210, must be undertaken. A. The stage of focusing the light of the mind and the light of matter in the mental vehicle. This is done by a process of lifting up and of blending and fusion, and to do this the activity of the creative imagination is employed. B. The stage of meditation, which in time brings about the fusion of the light of matter, the light of the mind, and the light of the soul upon the mental plane. C. The stage in which these three lights are realized to be one unified light, a searchlight ready to be turned in the needed direction. 3. The recognition of two aspects of preparedness. A. Alignment of the personality so that the three aspects of the lower nature are seen as constituting one functioning personality. B. An act of integration in which the personality and the soul are seen also as a unit. This is done through the dedication of the personality to the soul and its acceptance by the soul. These two lines of thinking produce a field of magnetic thought and realization in which all the work is done. 4. A pause in which the whole man braces himself for the work to be done. From a profound preoccupation with the stage of soul contact and initial preparation, he now focuses his attentive mind upon the glamour to be eradicated. This does not involve a consciousness of the glamour and its why and wherefore. It means a turning of the attention of the integrated soul personality to the astral plane and the particular glamour. The attention is not turned to the astral body of the aspirant seeking to do the work. This is a statement of major importance because in destroying the peculiar type of glamour with which he is concerned, the aspirant or disciple begins to destroy his share in it, that in him which gives him contact with the glamour, and at the same time he is preparing himself for group service along the same line. This will not prove an easy task. Roman numeral 2, the technique or formula. 5. By an act of the creative imagination, the worker endeavors to see and hear the soul, the source of light and power in the three worlds, breathing out the Om into the mind of the attentive waiting personality. There the light and power of the soul is retained and held by the positive personality, for a negative attitude is not desirable. 6. The retained light and power, combined with the dual light of the personality, focused, as we know, on the mental plane, is seen generating an intense light which can be visualized as a searchlight of great brilliance and strength. It must be seen as a sphere of vivid, brilliant light, but not yet radiating out or projecting outwards. 7. When this act of visualization is deemed to be satisfactorily accomplished, a pause then ensues wherein the aspirant focuses all the will he has behind the light, thus created by the fusion of the three lights. This refers to the stage spoken of by Patanjali as that of the mind held steady in the light. This use of the will, soul personality will, is dynamic, but at this stage quiescent and not magnetic or radiatory. 8. Next follows a process wherein the glamour to be dissipated and the searchlight of the mind are brought into relationship by the power of thought. The glamour and its quality and the searchlight and its power are recognized to be as they are, and the effect or effects to be brought about by that relationship are carefully thought out. This must not be done in such a way that the mind process, light and power will strengthen the already powerful glamour. It must be done in such a way that at the close of the process, the glamour will be appreciably weakened and eventually dissipated. This is an important realization. 9. Having, as far as possible, achieved the needed concentration, realization, and relationship, the aspirant then, by an act of the will and of the creative imagination, turns on the searchlight and sees a vivid beam of light stream forth and pierce the glamour. He must visualize a broad, brilliant beam pouring forth from the illumined mind onto the astral plane. He must believe that this is so. 10. Then comes an important and difficult phase of the work in which the worker names the glamour and sees it in process of dissipation. He aids the process by saying with tension and inaudibly, "The power of the light prevents the appearance of the glamour," naming it. "The power of the light negates the quality of the glamour from affecting me. The power of the light destroys the life behind the glamour." The saying of these three sentences constitutes an affirmation of power and of purpose and must be enunciated at a point of tension, with the mind held in steadiness and with a positive orientation. 11. Again, the sacred word is sounded with intent to produce what in occult parlance is called an act of penetration. The light is then seen accomplishing three things. A, making a definite impact upon the glamour. B, penetrating the glamour and being absorbed by it. C, dissipating it slowly. As time elapses, the glamour will never again be so powerful and will eventually disappear altogether. 12. This is followed by a process of withdrawing, wherein the aspirant consciously and deliberately withdraws the beam of light and reorients himself upon the mental plane. I would point out that glamour is never immediately dissipated. It is of too ancient an origin, but a persistent use of this formula will weaken the glamour, and slowly and inevitably it will vanish, and the man will walk free from that particular hindrance. This may seem like a very long formula, but I have purposely detailed it in as full a manner as possible, so that the aspirant may clearly apprehend what he is intended to do. After due practice and a faithful following of the required conditions, the aspirant will follow it well nigh automatically, and all that he will then need will be the formula reduced to the following brief outline. Brief outline of the formula. 1. The four preparatory stages. A. Recognition of the glamour to be dissipated. B. The stage of focusing the light of the personality, a dual light. C. The stage of meditation and the recognition of the greater light. D. The unification of the dual light of matter and the light of the soul, creating thus the searchlight of the mind. 2. A process of alignment and of recognized integration. 3. A deliberate turning of the searchlight of the mind to the astral plane. The formula. 4. Soul activity and the retention of the light. 5. The generating and visualizing of the searchlight. 6. The evocation of the will behind the searchlight of the mind. 7. The generated unified light is turned upon the glamour by the power of thought. 8. The naming of the glamour and the triple affirmation. 9. The act of penetration. 10. The process of withdrawing. You will see, brother of mine, that what I am in fact doing is teaching the coming generation how to destroy those forms of thought which hold the race in bondage, and which in the case of glamour are the forms which desire, emotion, sensitivity to environment, developing aspiration and old ideals have taken, and which prevent the light of the soul from illuminating the waking consciousness. The energies taking form upon the astral plane are not pure emotion and feeling clothed in pure astral matter, for there is no such thing. They are the instinctual desires evoked by the evolving substance of the physical plane, and this in its entirety and through the activity of the human family is being redeemed and drawn upwards, until some day we shall see the transfiguration of that substance and the glorification of the Virgin Mary, the mother aspect in relation to divinity. They are also the descending thought forms which the developing human being is always creating and drawing downwards into manifestation, clothing them with the substance of desire. When the descending forms of thought, a reflection in the three worlds of that vast cloud of knowable things in process of perception, as Patanjali calls it, and which hovers upon the buddhic plane awaiting precipitation, and the ascending mass of instinctual demands from the lower aspect of the human unit and from humanity as a whole, meet at a point of tension, then you have the appearance of what is known as the astral plane, a man-created sphere of activity. The subhuman kingdoms of nature know no astral plane. The superhuman kingdoms have surmounted it and discovered the secret of its delusion, and no longer recognize it except as a temporary field of experience wherein man lives. In that sphere he learns the fact that reality is none of these, but only the one and the other in relation with each other. This is one of the occult phrases which the disciple has to learn to understand, and which is descriptive of manifestation. B. The dissipation of group glamour and of world glamour. Group work in dissipating world glamour must be handled, as will be obvious to you, by those who are working at the dissipation of glamour in their own lives and have learnt to use the formula just given. The majority of those so working are sixth-ray aspirants, those who have sixth-ray personalities or whose soul ray is the sixth, plus those on all rays who have powerful sixth-ray astral vehicles. These make the most effective workers in the group, but are subject to one major difficulty. In spite of aspiration and good intention, they are seldom aware of the glamours which control them. It is exceedingly hard to induce a sixth-ray aspirant to admit that he is held by a glamour, particularly when it is glamour of spiritual connotation and of a very high order. In their case, the glamour is enhanced by the energy of devotion, which stiffens it and brings in a quality which makes it most difficult to penetrate. Their complete assurance proves a serious obstacle to clear-sighted work, because that has all to go before the work of dissipation can be carried forward successfully. First-ray people can overcome glamour with relative ease once they become aware of it as a personality limitation. Third-ray people are as susceptible to it as are those of the sixth-ray, and their devious, twisting, planning minds and the rapidity with which they can deceive themselves, and seek often to deceive others, greatly hinders their work of clearing away glamour. Their pronounced tendency to be the victims of glamour is evidenced by the inability of the third-ray aspirant and disciple to convey his meaning clearly by speech. He has guarded himself for many lives by devious formulations of thought and of ideas, and can seldom convey his meaning clearly. This is why sixth-ray people and third-ray people almost inevitably prove themselves unable to teach. Both these groups must, therefore, learn to use this formula, and they would greatly hasten the process of dissipation if they would force themselves to speak or write their thoughts clearly, if they would never be ambiguous or deal in half-thoughts, innuendo, or suggestion. They should clearly enunciate the ideas with which they may be dealing. The seventh-ray person is faced with the difficulty of being able to create exceedingly clear-cut thought forms, and the glamours, therefore, which control him are precise and definite, and to him, all-compelling. They rapidly crystallize, however, and die their own death. Second-ray aspirants are usually fully aware of any glamour which may be seeking to hold them, because they have an innate faculty of clear perception. Their problem is to kill out in themselves their rapid response to the magnetic pull of the astral plane and its many and widespread glamours. They are not so frequently responsive to a glamour as to all glamours in a relatively temporary manner, but one which is nevertheless exceedingly delaying to their progress. Because of their clear-sightedness, they add to this sensitivity to glamour an ability to suffer about it and to register their responsiveness as a sin and failure, and thus delay their liberation from it by a negative attitude of inferiority and distress. They will profit enormously from a constant use of the formula until the time comes when they are aware of the glamour or glamours, but are not touched by them. Fifth-ray people suffer the least from glamour, but are primarily the victims of illusion, and for them the technique of the presence is all important, because it brings in a factor which the true fifth-ray person is apt to negate and refuse to admit, the fact of the higher self. He feels self-sufficient. They respond so easily and with such satisfaction to the power of thought. Pride in their mental competence is their besetting sin, and they are therefore set in their purposes and preoccupied with the world of the concrete and the intellectual. The moment that the angel of the presence is a reality to them, their response to illusion weakens and disappears. Their major problem is not so much the negation of the astral body, for they are apt to despise its hold, but they have a major difficulty in recognizing that which the mind is intended to reveal, the divine spiritual self. Their lower concrete mind interposes itself between them and the vision. Fourth-ray people are peculiarly prone to fall into glamour, and thus to produce a condition which is one of extreme difficulty. I might define their problem by saying that they tend to bring their illusions down to the astral plane and there clothe them with glamour, and have consequently a double problem upon their hands. They are faced with a unification of glamour and illusion. They are, however, a group of souls which will eventually reveal the true nature of the intuition, and this will be the result of their illusory, glamorous fight in the world of appearances. We come now to the consideration of the formula to be used by those who seek to serve humanity by deliberately breaking up and dispersing the glamours which hold the race in thrall, and who know the need to do this in group formation. Certain individual characteristics are essential for the personnel of such groups. First of all, there must be an ability to work without attachment to results, and to use the formula for a given length of time, for instance, once a week, for 2 years or more, without looking for results. They need to realize that they can never know whether they are successful or not, because the glamours they are attempting to dissipate are so widespread and general that effects cannot be grasped by their individual minds. They are too close to the picture. Their perspective has necessarily to be that of the immediate foreground. Secondly, they must have an intelligent appreciation of what constitutes a world glamour so that they can occultly name it and, by so doing, contact it. They must, thirdly, be accustomed to the work of dispersing glamour in their own lives. The necessity to do this and their success in so doing are factors which indicate their suitability for the task. They must, finally, love their fellow men. This they must not do as the sixth-ray person loves them, with an isolating devotion, but as the second-ray person loves, with an all-round appreciation of humanity, an understanding heart, plus a critical mind, which loves steadily, in spite of error seen, with a clear-sighted perception of the assets and the debits of an individual or a race. The ability to do this is one of the factors which enables the sixth-ray aspirant to transfer off the minor sixth-ray and find his place upon the major second-ray, as must all sixth- and fourth-ray initiates. One of the requirements in this group work is a most careful choice of those who are to participate in the work. They must be chosen because they can work together. They must either know each other exceedingly well and be free from personality frictions, or they must be relatively unknown to each other as personalities, but are drawn to each other as sole collaborators in this particular work. They must, as far as in them lies, endeavor to work with regularity, so that a rhythm can be set up which will lead to a steady rhythmic impact of the light upon the glamour. They must also adhere faithfully to the formula given. This is one of the initial formulas and is most powerful because it is one of the very first to be used in group dissipation of glamour. This whole procedure is entirely new as far as man is concerned, and the work to be done will necessarily prove hard as it involves an interesting situation. The groups who will do this work of piercing the glamours which dim the vision of humanity and of dissipating them will be the first non-initiate groups to work this way upon the physical plane and to work consciously and with fixed intent. Hitherto, the work has been carried forward by members of the hierarchy and then only with the idea of holding back the glamours until such time as humanity was ready to destroy that which it had created. Glamours have also been pierced before now by massed effort, carried forward for a long time, and usually without any very real conscious understanding. An illustration of this would be the work done by the Church in a diffused and vague way in piercing the glamour of material desire and material good by substituting the idea of a heavenly substitute. The work that is now planned is dynamic and clear-cut, consciously carried forward and specific in its impact. It is a definite method of handling and projecting the energy of light with the objective of destroying the impediments of an emotional mental nature upon the path of return to God. It is desirable and aids an easier and more concentrated form of work if the group can meet together for the use of the formula. If, however, this proves not possible, then the personnel of the group can arrange to work apart, but with the idea of the work being group work firmly realized, and with the steady recognition of the members who form the group body. This is necessary both for the pooling of the light and also for protection from the glamour to be attacked. This pooling of the light is a major requirement and must ever be borne in mind. Whenever possible, the rule should be that the work is done at some definite planned group meeting, even if this entails quite drastic sacrifice on the part of some of the members. I advise that some glamour which all the group members recognize as a major hindrance to the progress of humanity be one of the first handled by the group. I would also advise that in the early stages of their work, they deal with a glamour affecting aspirants, and that they do not attempt to tackle the more widely spread and deeply centered glamours of the race as a whole. Let them develop facility in handling some of the lesser and more easily visualized glamours. Then, as time goes on and facility in the work is gained, the group can pass to the more difficult tasks and handle the glamours further removed from their own orbit of difficulties. It is surely needless for me to point out that the group members be but those who are endeavouring to keep their own lives free from glamour. I would also add that if a group member is in the thick of glamour himself and is occupied with wrestling with it, he should abstain from the group work until he has freed himself with the aid of the individual formula. Those who can face themselves with an open eye and who see the truth as it is, who can face the same facts in connection with humanity, and can stand serene and unafraid in the face of the worst kind of discoveries about themselves and the world of men, are those who will employ this technique with the most success. I would also remind you that the group will need to protect itself from the glamour or glamours which it is attempting to dissipate. Their individual tendency to glamour is the factor which gives them the right to serve in this way, but it also lays them open to danger, and for this a protective formula will be necessary. The formula will therefore be divided into three parts. 1. The preparatory stages. 2. The use of the protective formula. 3. Group formula for the dissipation of glamour. The work done by the individual in dealing with his personal problems of glamour will greatly facilitate the preparatory work of the group. You will note that in outlining to you this work, I make no reference to the type of room, to the position of the group members, to posture assumed, to the use of incense, or to any of the paraphernalia which so many occult groups deem of importance. The set physical rituals are today, from the angle of the hierarchy, entirely obsolete and of no importance where disciples and advanced aspirants are concerned. They are of value to the little evolved in whom the sense of drama has to be developed and who need external aids, and they do provide a setting which serves to help beginners to keep the theme of their work and their objective in view. The only ritual which is still regarded as of value to the human family as a whole, particularly to the advanced person, is the Masonic ritual. The reason for this is that it is a pictorial representation of the process of creation, of the relation between God and man, of the path of return, and also of those great initiations through the means of which the liberated initiate passes into the council chamber of the Most High. But with the exception of this, the small petty rituals of position and of physical relations in respect to attitude and seating arrangements are regarded as unnecessary and as usurping frequently the attention which should be given to the work in hand. Those using these formulas are presumed to have acquired some measure of inner polarization and to be able to withdraw themselves to their spiritual center in any place and at any time. This is the center of quiet thought, from whence the work is carried on. All that is needed as a preface to this group work is 10 minutes of complete silence in which the group members attempt to set up that magnetic field of positive receptive activity, note here the paradoxes of the occult sciences, which will make the rest of the work possible. The leader of the group, chosen in rotation so that all the members of the group occupy that position, starts the work by calling the names of the group members, and as each name is called, the other group members look directly into the eyes of the one named, who rises and for a minute faces them. Thus a rapport and a relationship is established, because the directive magnetic force of each soul is always reached from eye to eye. This is the occult significance of the words, "Can you look me in the eye?" or "They eyed each other," and similar phrases. Then, having established this interlocking relationship, the group sits in silence for 10 minutes. This is done in order to withdraw the consciousness from all world and personal affairs and center it upon the work to be done. At the end of that time, the leader names the glamour with which the group is to be occupied. There will be no dissension anent the glamour at the time of the group meeting, because the group members, outside the meetings and for a month prior to undertaking the task of dissipating the glamour, will have made a study of it, its implications, its historicity and effects, psychological, individual, group and national, and also its widespread influence over humanity as a whole. The experience of the group in this type of work will determine the nature of the glamour to be dealt with.
End of side 2, cassette number 5, page 205 of Glamour, A World Problem, continued on cassette number 6.